This is the Global Sport Matters podcast. I'm Andrew Ramsamy. On Friday, September 25th, we are launching our next digital issue on the reset of college sport. In that issue, we'll be covering stories ranging from a look over the past decade of hiring of Division I head coaches and the NCAA Power 5 Conference to the impact and legacy of the late John Thompson and what he meant to the world of college basketball. We will kick the digital issue off with a return of GSM Live, our virtual event on Thursday, September 24th. Joining us that day will be Fitz Hill, former head football coach at San Jose State University, C. Keith Harrison, DeVos Associate Unit Head and Chief Academic Officer, Richard Lapchek, Endowed Chair and Director at the DeVos Sport Business Management at UCF, Sam Sachs, founder of the No Hate Zone, Karen Gallagher, senior researcher here at the Global Sport Institute, and our very own Ken Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute. That's going to be on Thursday, September 24th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. To register for this event, visit globalsportmatters.com/events or click on the link in our podcast show notes. And now, the show. If your hunger for live sport during this pandemic wasn't replaced by what appeared to be a very well-timed volume of sport documentary premieres, well, you might have been living under a rock, and understandably so. But if you haven't been living under a rock, and you have been watching sports documentaries, perhaps in your diet was a show from Netflix called Last Chance U. Jason Kirk from SB Nation called Last Chance U, quote, "carefully crafted drama with personalities to care about," end quote. And in this summer's season 5 of Last Chance U, there was one personality that stood out amongst the crowd.
John Beam, a legend now, 40 years coaching football.
I think he woke up pissing fire. When I tell you to shut up, it better stop.
Why are you talking when he's talking?
Coach Beam is the man, real talk. He really kept brothers off the street. He was a father figure.
This dude want to win everything.
Oh, damn.
If the game is the hustle, I'm putting my money on Beam.
Beam gonna be Beam every day.
Y'all gonna be my age one day. Look, I'm in great shape.
John Beam's career in football spans 40 years. And in that time, he's impacted so many lives, including our own Scott Brooks from the Global Sport Institute, who joins me in conversation with Coach John Beam. I'm Andrew Ramsamy, and today on the Global Sport Matters podcast, John Beam and what it's like to be a coach in this new era of sport. So joining me now are Scott Brooks and the one and only coach, John Beam. John, how are you this morning?
I'm awesome. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. You were saying that Scott and I get up too early now compared to what you're getting up to.
That's different. You know, usually at this time of the year, you know, if I'm up at 8 a.m., that's because we're in double days, right? I got to get to work by 9, so I get up, get a little breakfast, get a little film, and then hustle in. But without football, I'm like, okay, I can get up out of bed, you know, around 8, not be ready to work at 8, but, you know, just get out of bed, get my life ready, starting at 8. So it's different.
So set the stage. I mean, you've been doing football now for 40 years. We're
yes,
now
sir.
Talking, you know, September 14th. We're still in the midst of COVID. What has this world of COVID been like for you, and how has it impacted you and your operations?
Boy, it's really changed. You know, I laugh. I told everybody I've been coaching 40 years, and year 41 was going to be a bye. So I won't coach in 2020, really, right? I'll coach it maybe twice in 21 with us moving, with the community college in California moving to spring. So we're hoping that we got the okay to start on in-person conditioning. So our first session will be tomorrow, actually. So I'll see my players in person for the first time tomorrow if – you know, the smoke quality in the Bay Area is good, right? If they can get all their paperwork done and get in our app to work for the health survey they have to do every day, if that's working and they can get signed up on it. So my life is not designing X's and O's right now. It's designing ways to beat COVID and to keep our young people safe. And so I'm doing research and reading articles every day, you know, not about the opponent that I will be playing, but the opponent that I don't know, which is COVID.
And Scott, you've known John for a while. There's some personal family connections to Coach Bean. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it's funny. Coach and I we haven't met in person. But my brother, who's just a year ahead of me, played for Coach Bean, and I think it would have started in 86, 87, 88, and graduated. He graduated in 89. And so my brother was a good high school football player, ended up getting a scholarship to play at the Air Force Academy. And we hadn't played any football going into high school. So really he learned the game from Coach Bean. And he would come home and talk to me about, you know, how much he hated practice, which I played a little bit of football and I didn't like practice either. All the yelling and screaming. We got enough from pops at home. But he loved to hit. My brother was a hitter. That's what he loved to do. And I got to go to some of the games. I played, again, a little bit of football at the JV level. And then at my high school, you had to pick. That's the way our coach was, and I picked basketball. But I learned a lot about Coach Bean from watching and hearing from my brother. So I feel like he was a coach for me as well. And my brother and Coach Bean are still close. And so, you know, my brother cites my dad. He cites one or two people from the military, and he cites Coach Bean. And so, you know, coaches have that kind of an impact. They change families, right? They're not just coaching that kid that's with them. They're also coaching those family members. And that's the way I feel about Coach Bean. One of the great coaches in the town, as we call Oakland, a legend in terms of football, undefeated seasons. You know, their team was phenomenal. Watching them, I knew that my high school's team couldn't compete. It made me want to – I didn't even feel like playing for my team was playing real football when I looked at that team.
So why did you go to O'Dowd then?
So I went to O'Dowd, the Catholic school coach, because you remember we moved back to Oakland.
From Saudi
Arabia, and I was in ninth grade, and Skyline didn't start at ninth grade. So I was either going to have to go to – you know, Montera had the lottery system. We had missed that timing. And so, you know, I'm looking at what, King Estates?
Yep, King.
and my folks were like, Scott, you should just go to O'Dowd. And I tested and got in. And I wanted to quit. Every year I wanted to leave O'Dowd. I asked to go to Skyline or to go to St. Joe's, where Jason Kidd was eventually. But my dad was convinced that I should stay at O'Dowd because of the academics. So
I didn't see, that's the part of the story I never quite got. So that was good. You know, Todd and I always laugh. He just, you know, but it made sense that you get started in high school.
Yep.
Coach, when you hear these stories going back so many years, you know, you have sent over 100 plus players to the D1 level as a high school coach. Talk about those early days of being a high school coach and creating such a favorable impression to people like, you know, like Scott and his brother. And what does that role of a coach mean, even at that high school level?
When you take on the role of a coach or a teacher, in my opinion, you take on that role for life, right? You don't just teach for six period, you know, that 50 minute block. And I think that's what's missing. You're teaching them the whole day. And if you do it right, that education continues, right, for life. But that education's got to be a two-way street, because as I, quote, impart knowledge on these young people, they impart knowledge on me as well. And that's what I think my secret of success was that understanding that dynamic, right? You know, it's so rewarding to when the show Last Chance You came out and all the accolades and everything that came out, you know, you get a, you know, you're the guy from the town getting a full page article about you in the Sunday New York Times. That's pretty cool, right? Not as cool as getting hit by people that I coached or taught 30 and 40 years ago saying that they remember that I made a difference in their lives because they moved away or whatever, right? That means that you impacted something on someone for a lifetime. Isn't that the knowledge we want to give? When we say we're teachers, right, it's not just the three R's. Remember that? Reading, writing, and arithmetic. You remember those? Well, you guys are probably too young.
No, I remember it.
But it's really about the education of life, right? And to care for each other and to have a dynamic that gives each of us give something back to each other. And I think that's what's really important.
You know, one of the things, Coach was a teacher at a younger school level. And I think that that's also one of his secrets to success. As I study coaches, you know, you've already heard how he thinks about it. You're a teacher for life, but he is a community coach, as we call it. And a community coach is known by generations. They're known and accepted by families, so that when a kid comes to coach at a high school level, and he's already been teaching at Grammar Middle School level, there's already a relationship with families. And so when they come home and they complain about coach, you'll have family members who will say, hey, coach is okay. He's someone you could trust. He's someone we trust. And if he says do it, then you better do it. And that's very different than when you're someone who works outside of schools and nobody knows you and you just come in to coach. So you might have a no knock on people who have outside jobs, but you just don't have that same connection.
Yeah, I think it's important that people understand that, right? Is that you are a member of the community, right? And we all have our jobs in our community, right? Whatever that is. And they're all important jobs. And so, you know, it's something that you can't take lightly. And working at the junior high, to be honest, right, I learned so much about how to be a teacher, right? I tell everybody, you know, if you can teach at frickin' Havens Court, you can teach anywhere in the world, right? Because it's about classroom management, but it's also about connecting to people where they trust you, right? Building the trust base. And I can tell you this. So think about this, right? So I'm teaching in the inner city, right, at Frick. And, you know, I made them dress every day for PE in the locker room. And you know what? And there's only one male PE teacher. It's me. And you got all, you know, three classes. So, you know, maybe 75 to 100 young men in there. And you have to keep problems from happening. Well, at that time in the 80s, the early 80s, the problems were money, right? Because of people selling drugs. So the rule is you can't have no money. You know, you can't bring big wads of money in the locker room. I'm not going to have it, right? And if you do, I'm going to take it. And so guys would come in with this big roll, you know, because they've been out, you know, out at the corner, you know, slanging, right? And I take their money and I make them call home. Remember now, we had pay phones, we had cell phones. So the kid had to get, there's a pay phone in the gym, had to get on the pay phone, call his big brother or his mom or somebody to come pick up the money. And they would. And the kid, the families knew the rules. Now, I don't know that's a rule that you really publish, you know what I'm saying? But they understood because we don't want that money to be a problem, right? And so I'd take these rolls off these 7th, 8th, 9th graders, and then their, you know, brother or mom will come in, you know, and take the roll. I'm sure smack them a couple of times when they went home. But guess what? The rolls of cash didn't come back. And so the locker room didn't have theft going on, right? Or people didn't want to. So one excuse was, well, I can't dress. Why? Well, they didn't want to say why. Well, because they had this big chunk of money. They didn't want to lock in the locker room and get it stolen. So they just don't bring it. Now, I don't know where they put the money, but they didn't bring it to the gym. How about that? So we kind of had it worked out pretty good.
So see, you're learning some stuff about Oakland right now, Andrew. You're learning something from the town. I know you're from New York, but you're here in Frick and Havens Court. Those are real schools. Those are two of the toughest schools in Oakland. You got East Oakland and West Oakland, and that's East Oakland. And you know, when you got policies on, you can't bring a wad, and we're talking about junior high. That tells you about the town. That tells you about the town.
Talk about the town, Coach Beam. I mean, it was something that played into the documentary. We kind of got to see it a little bit on the periphery. We got to see a lot of it through the characters. And obviously we saw a lot of it through just the team itself. You know, all of these different individuals coming together to try to, at the junior college level, hopefully get that D1 or D2 scholarship. So what is the town of Oakland, and what has that been for you for these past 40 years?
It's a great question. I want you to look at it. I know with Scott's basketball background, so let's just look at it through his background, right? Gary Payton, Jason Kidd, Damian Lillard, point guards, leaders, scrappy, don't back down, right? they are the picture of what the town is all about, right? These are guys that, you know, made it through Oakland, came with a chip on their shoulder, and were successful in the biggest spotlight we have worldwide, right? Marshawn Lynch. Think about him, right? What he symbolizes, right? This tough guy on the street, tough guy running the ball. Tough guy, I don't care if you want me to interview. That ain't who I am. I ain't going to do it. Right, boss? Right? You know what I mean? That's his deal. So Oakland has this mentality that we are going to stand alone. We're okay being individuals, right? And we're going to stand and hold our own line, our peace, and whatever that is, right? This is who we are. They're scrappy. No one believes in them, right? But you got to teach them to make it happen, right? And then you have to then say, okay, when it stands alone, it doesn't look very good by itself, right? But that's okay. It's like a quilt, right? That quilt is made up a bunch of discarded pieces of material or old things you wore that your grandmother cut up or your mother cut up. And they took those squares and sewed it together. And when they sewed it together, look at the tapestry that you have of this quilt. Beautiful. Made up of all different colors, all different shapes and sizes. That's what Oakland is. Oakland's the most diverse city in the country. More languages spoke here than anywhere else, including New York. And so all these differences, we can look at them and go, oh, well, there are all these differences and it will never work. Or you can look at it and go, what do we have in common? And that's the grit, the determination to stand up and be counted in essence, right? And who you are. But we need people here to make sure we show the way, because a lot of people lose their way. They don't believe they can make it out. And so we have to constantly prove to them that they can, because they're beaten down, right? They're beaten down by society. They're beaten down by structures like of school systems. They're beaten down physically and mentally by their own families, right? Because of abuse and different things. And we have to lift them up. We have to tell them that they're important, that they can be somebody. You know the old thing, I am somebody, right? Those are the things that they're cliches, but they're true. And you just have to constantly reinforce that.
You know, when I think about Oakland, it's funny. What I loved about The Last Chance U and how it featured Oakland was you got to see Samoans, which in Oakland, you know, we know about Samoan culture, and particularly when you're talking about football players that coach had. My brother would come home and talk about how Samoan teammates were roasting pigs on a spit after the game. And we definitely didn't have that at my Catholic school, but you had it at different parts. You know, to coach's point, over 27 different Asian dialects spoken in Oakland. You're talking about a rich Latino culture. Of course, it has been known as one of the black cities. It has declined in that percentage, but we've had a history of black mayors. You're talking about the Black Panthers that had a huge presence. You're talking about music. I mean, Oakland is so rich, and it is a big city, but it's not big by, you know, it's not going to be in the top 5 or top 10. It's somewhere around 50th in terms of size. It's not so big. You know, we're the city across from San Francisco. We sit, excuse me, in that shadow. And so that's part of the chip on our shoulder. And I think, you know, one of the other pieces that Last Chance you just kind of alluded to, and you got just small glimpses of, is even when you have a player like Ray, who's driving an hour and a half one way, his family often have roots in Oakland. And that's, you know, the Oakland that I grew up in, when you're talking about the 70s and the 80s, you had black enclaves in the hills and you had blacks in the flats always. But it gentrified in such a way and became so expensive that many black families, particularly if you were right there working middle class and so on, you got pushed out. So you have the poorest of Oakland actually got to stay. But if you were trying to move out and move up, you couldn't stay in Oakland. You were priced out of the market. And so, you know, that's how a Ray, whose family started in Oakland at some point, gets moved an hour and a half out, because that's the only way you can buy a house. It's too expensive in Oakland. And that's one of the stories that, you know, they talked about, but you just don't, unless you're from Oakland, you don't know it fully. And to get moved out of your city, right? We hear about gentrification, but we don't actually always talk to the people who actually got displaced. And that's a loss for us as well. And Oakland has felt losses in different ways. The Raiders have left, come back. Now they're leaving. The Warriors are now leaving and going, have left and gone to San Francisco. Oakland has this where we get things ripped from us. They tear from us, and yet we still persist. So it has a lot of pride, but Oakland is really this great mix of different people.
And I think in Ray's story, what's interesting, right? Ray's mom, a single mom at the point, right? Because the dad, before he was killed, they were separated. But she knew that she needed to get a job to take care of her family. She wanted to get a house, right? Because they'd lived in Oakland. And to buy a house, and she's a longshore woman, right? Which is a good job, a good career. But even being a longshore woman, she couldn't afford a house in Oakland to, with a good size house, right? You know, so she could have her extended family at. And that's the difference you had to move to. I think it's really important for people to understand that. The other thing I think what's going to be interesting is, you know, Warriors, right? You talk about the Warriors, right? They were a horrible franchise, right? But they still sold out all the time. And if you went to a Warrior game, which I've got to be able to, right, even when the Mark, you know, before Mark Jackson and Steve Kerr, but back in the Don Nelson days, right, we believe, that place would be rocking, right? But when you walk through that the arena, it looked like Oakland, right? Okay? Fast forward now to the end of the reign in Oakland with Curry and Kerr and Draymond and Iguodala, right, and Clay. The crowd started to change. The ticket prices started to change, right? But it still had Oakland in there. I went to two games over in the city this year. Oh, my God. It was sterile. Now, they weren't very good, right? But it just didn't – there was no vibe. There was no energy, right? I mean, they've got the club seats now. They're in a bunker. So you have your bunker underground where you can't see anything, but you have people serving you, you know, your wine and cheese and shit, right? Then you go upstairs to kind of look at the game. I mean, come on, really? This is ridiculous, right? I mean, they're gonna be a good team and win, but I don't know if they're gonna win to the extent because the crowd will not be rocking like it was. You know, how you gonna have these bro dudes from Silicon Valley trying to rock with you in the stadium, man? Come on now. I just don't see it. I could be wrong, but we'll find out.
So, Coach, what is it like to coach at Atlanta? And what is it? I mean, the TV show Last Chance U is a construct, right, of putting together all of this energy and emotion. But if the cameras weren't there, if it wasn't recorded, what is it like coaching there when, you know, there isn't a camera that exists?
So Laney is, if you ask Todd, who played for me last in 1988, right, and you ask people that, I haven't changed. So that was one of the things I wanted to make sure that I didn't play for the cameras. I think Ray a little bit at times played for the cameras, you know, some of the stuff that you catch in the locker room or the training room was a little bit playing to the cameras. But I hope what you saw was really who we are, right? I'm going to get after your ass. We're going to get, you know, we're going to win. We're going to have fun. I'm going to do something goofy, you know, at practice, you know, make everybody laugh. I'm going to bust their tail about stuff, you know, on classes. I'm going to look out for things for them to be where there's more than football, right? What are you going to do with your life afterwards, right? You know, where are you going? You know, as black men, brown men, you know, you can't just put it all on football, right? You have a better chance of being a doctor or a PhD than you do being in the NFL or the NBA, really, right? When you just look at numbers, right? So showing those types of things, but allowing them to still have their dream. You're going to see all that. I mean, you're going to see me challenge them about things that in their lives, you know, that I'm going to call them out. I'm not afraid to embarrass you, right? And I'm going to tell your business too, right? You know, like, hey, let's go ahead. You want to tell me your business? All right, let's get it out there. You're like, okay, like with New, you're the president of the Pathfinders Club, this Polynesian club on campus that's supposed to be helping young Polynesian men navigate in the old ways, in essence of, you know, adulthood. And yet you plagiarize, you don't go to class. So I walked into that meeting in front of everybody, was filmed, and said, that's a leader. And he had to come, and, you know, to his credit, he accepted that he didn't do what he was supposed to do, right? And that you know, that he screwed up. And so what did he do? He came back, he figured it out, and went ahead and got a full scholarship. But when he figured it out, was really because no one has taught him before, right? When you're a young kid going to public schools, right, plagiarism is not illegal. That's how you get over, right? You and your buddies do some stuff, right? I mean, I don't get it, right? You know, we always talk about it. The smart kids, they all have study groups together, right? Y'all work it out. You get together. You know, your doctorate students, right, Scott, in there, they're working out their paper, coming together and collaborating. But when we do it in the inner city, that's how you get it done. But all of a sudden, it's illegal, right? So we have to show them that it's not illegal. You just have to give someone else credit for it. You got to learn how to footnote. And they're looking at me like, Coach, what the hell is a footnote? Ain't no one taught them that in high school. So we have to explain. You give credit to somebody, then you come up with your own conclusions for other people's research, right? So those are things that we have to teach them. And it's a struggle. And I'm definitely not an English guy, so I don't know how to write that well, but we'll figure it out, you know, together. We'll figure this thing out. I'll figure out how to go to the writing center and cheat there. Like I tell them, the writing center is a way for you to cheat. They go, really? We can cheat there? Yeah. How do we teach, Coach? Well, when you turn in your draft, they'll correct it for you. Really? They'll do that for you? Yeah. You just got to turn in the draft. Okay. I got you. So now the kids, that's a hustle, right? They think they play in the system. So they go to the writing center to cheat, to get over on the teacher. Well, guess who's winning this one? I am, right? Because the writing center is really the help they needed. But if they didn't put it in that contest that they were getting over on them, they may not make it to the writing center. So you got to explain that to them, right? And that's what we're doing. We're teaching them. I think Scott told me this one time. There's a code, right? And we're helping them decode certain things. Just like we're helping teachers decode what our students, our players are saying, we got to help our students decode what the system really wants from them. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help be decoders.
Just to defend myself, I did not cheat in high school.
No.
I actually was not. I was excluded from a lot of the study groups, didn't even know that they were happening in high school because of those different racial dynamics. So I'm just going to stand up for myself and say, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. When we have honor students, they get together, they know how to cooperate. We know that there are certain groups. I won't call out different groups, ethnic groups or whatever, but they do better collectively. They work together on these things and they get that work done. And working with our kids, there is something about the strength in them wanting to resist the way that they feel that they're getting excluded and mistreated. And so when you're and there's a strength, we talk about it. The hustler is that's a compliment when someone says you're a hustler, right? And that you grind, and the slickster, right? That whether that's pimp culture, whether that's old Nat Turner, kind of the revolt culture. There's something about that strength. And so to coach, that's genius, right? To understand it. And this is what you get from a community coach and somebody who knows. Somebody who knows understands that motivates kids. Somebody who knows understands that even though we hear from sports psychologists that you're supposed to be, you know, have some kind of autonomous motivation, right? It should be intrinsic, not extrinsic. That's not how it is for our kids. Our kids, there's pride. There's I'm representing my family. And that's what drives our kids, this community, this pride. And so it doesn't go with what we hear from a white normative standard about how you're supposed to be best motivated. And coach understands that. And that's what community coaches who dig in, who get to know the kids, this is that psychology that coaches don't get enough credit for when they're from the inner city and they work with inner city kids. There's a skill set here, and coach has that skill set. He's able to motivate because he understands what drives these kids, and he values it, right? He values their family. He knows that the family plays a role. Can't be afraid to go to their homes and get to know who they are. So with Anu, you hear coach is able to say, your brother. Now, your brother was a good football player, but you could be a great football player. And coach knows what that does to Nuu, right? And when he talks about, yeah, your brother was almost there, but he had some challenges. Coach is asking him, are you afraid of leaving town? Are you strong enough? Can you leave town and make a better life for your family? Or are you stuck at thinking you should stay here in Oakland? Those are the ways that you challenge these young men to be able to stretch out and to think, I want to do this big thing. I want to change my family's trajectory. I want to leave a legacy. And Coach knows how to pull those cords. He knows how to get them to strive for what it is they want, but don't know how to go get it.
I want you to think about this too, Scott, right? Remember I told you that the educator, right, is your, for life, but it's a two-way street. I learned some of that from your brother, Todd. So think about this, right? He's at the Air Force Academy. First of all, he's black, coming from an inner city school, gets a scholarship to the Air Force Academy, right? That's not heard of, correct?
Right.
Right? Not supposed to, right? Especially in the earlier time when he went, right, which was 88, 89. And so he plays 2 years, and then he quits playing. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, why'd you quit? He said, man, coach, it became like they thought I was a sucker. They were, you know, I wanted to prove to them I wasn't here because I was a football player, right? That I was here because of my own merit. So he didn't play football anymore, and he ended up being on the commandant's list, mm-hmm. right? Because he had to prove to people, man, about this hustle, right, that I'm going to do. So then he gets his commission in the Air Force, right? And because of his lacking great eyesight at that time, he couldn't fly. So, he's going to be an engineer, which is pretty dog, you know, like, okay, yeah, your backup plans, you're an engineer now, right? But as he was an engineer, he took all these courses that the government paid for him to take while he was being an engineer, right? He'd go work with Caltrans, all these different things that while he was going to working, he would still continue his education at the government's. That's the hustler in him. Right?
That's right.
And at the same time, he's networking with future employers in the field that he wants to be in engineering outside of the service.
That's right.
That's what I learned, right? The hustle never ends. Even when you're here, you are, you know, you're a graduate for the United States Air Force Academy. You know, you're an officer, and yet you still understand that you have to hustle, right? Because even though you wear the uniform of the Blue Air Force, people still see you as a black man.
That's right.
Right? And whatever that means to those folks, right? I don't want to get into it, but we don't know. I'm not going to judge them, but it meant something to them, right?
That's right.
And so he had to prove to them again, them being the establishment, that he wasn't just there as an athlete. He was there because he deserved to be there and he earned the right to be there. So I think that those are things I learned from him, and I share that with folks all the time, you know, and I think it's important.
Yeah.
Coach, can you talk about your coaching style? I mean, you said that for the most part, you know, that you have not changed over the past 40 years, but different styles of coaching have now come into play where some coaches may not want to use curse words. Some coaches.
Oh, shit. You going to talk about that shit with me?
Well, I mean, you know, but sometimes you know,
yeah.
with certain players you would connect really well with, and that style would work with them. And then people like RJ, you know, you and RJ would butt heads.
So I think there's a couple things that we have to understand, right? If anybody says you can get to everybody 100%, they lie. No one can, right? I mean, there's been one perfect person in this world, right? And he died on a cross. You know what I mean? And so we got to understand that we're not perfect. And so we're going to make mistakes. I do cuss, you know, I think it's a words that come out sometimes and they just come out, you know, like, hey, I don't even know where they come. I try to be creative with them. You know what I mean? They just come out, but it gets understood. When I was younger, I probably, you know, like when Todd's played for me and guys there, they'll let you know, man, I would grab a kid, pick his ass up off the ground and let him know. I'd be face to face with them, right? And we let them know. And then if they thought that they could, you know, man up, so to speak, all right, brother, let's go. And I slammed their ass down. Let's do it. So I never swung money, but you know, sometimes you just got to pick their asses up. And you know, there are words that come out, you know, and I'm an educated man, but I also think part of my education is that knowing when to use the words I use and how to use them. Right. And to sometimes for me, I'll get after one of my coaches instead of the player. Because then the player goes, wait a minute, this coach is protecting me, right, from Coach Bean's wrath. I need to do better because I don't want him to keep catching. I'm the one making a mistake. You know, so with the receivers, that was one of the things that came through pretty clearly over the years, right, with young Adam. Adam played for me and was my quarterback and then went to Kentucky State and came back and he started coaching with me. And so that would happen sometimes. Sometimes you have to lay it out with somebody else. the way that you have to get to people, you have to find the ways to pull their string, whatever that is. So language, the hug, you know, bringing up something like with Ray, really? Shut the fuck up, Ray. You know what? I've had guys play in the NFL. I've had guys go to the Super Bowl. You ain't did shit yet. When you're telling me how good you are, motherfucker, you ain't did shit. And I needed to tell him that. And that kind of grabbed him. A year before, I never had those conversations with Ray, because Ray's older brother, Shawnee, was there. And Shawnee took over the role of his dad after their dad was shot and killed. And so Shawnee would tell Ray to shut the hell up, right? Because we ain't did nothing, right? But when Shawnee left, Ray now had to stand on his own. And he struggled with standing on his own as being a man and being a leader, right? He had been the little brother. And when you're the little brother, right, Scott, sometimes you take that role on and you forget that, wait a minute, I got to change the dynamics. Yep. And you can be, and even in my household, right, I'm this alpha male and everything. But when I get with my sister, who's 10 years older than me and, you know, barely 100 pounds, she still dominates my ass, right? Because she's my big sister, right? And that's the dynamics in the family. And so we need to create those dynamics on our field, in our classrooms, in the weight room and stuff, so we have this understanding. And then it all works. But at the same time, when you rip somebody, you better be ready to hug their asses up. And that was the one thing in Last Chance Shoot, you don't see RJ and I hug up at different times, right? But I'm not going to lie, RJ's frustrating now, right? There's just some of them kids that, they get frustrating, right? And with the talent that he has, it's not as good as he thinks it is, but his work ethic is phenomenal. But there's something that would disconnect, that he continues to make the same mistakes. And I can't figure out how to get him to understand that, we sit there and watch film. He acknowledges on film, right? We do it in practice. He acknowledges in practice. And then in the game, it reverts back. So I don't know if the disconnect will ever work, or maybe just need to hear it from a different person, right? From a different voice than mine. And hopefully that will work for him, right? But sometimes there's just a disconnect and there's nothing that you can do about it, right?
You know, there's a couple of points that Coach brings up. One, you just taught me something new, and that is about the assistant coaches. So I coached with an old head in Philly, and I remember a few times when he came at me really hard, and I wasn't thinking about how he was projecting on me to get to this kid, and he definitely was. You saying it is now just clicked. That's what that was. And there were a lot of different ways in which he had those kinds of tactics, right? We get into an overtime game when we should have won. We make a dumb play. They score with a late three, and he's yelling and cursing, but he's leaning into our huddle and saying, "Hey guys, it's all right. We're gonna be all right." So he's literally putting on a show.
Yes.
But he's inside, we're laughing, right? And that's because he wanted to cool us out. Like, yes, we messed up. The team messed up, right? I'm the assistant. We messed up this lead, should have won, and we're upsetting a giant, a Goliath of a team. But that kind of stuff brings the team closer together, because he, instead of people now getting upset about the fact we're in this overtime when we shouldn't have been and getting tight and worrying, he's now just found a way to loosen them up, joke about it, tell them everything is okay, and he is distracting the crowd and the other team. The other team even thinks that there's something really going on while we know what's really going on inside our unit. And part of that, we study the value of linguistic capital, and particularly with inner city kids, with kids of color. And in that, there's the genius of what is the language of the people. And when you have young men who have to go through adultification, who have to become adults earlier on, cursing is what kids do anyway. I remember when my younger son talked about it, his tongue was tingling, right, the first time he used a curse word. And when you're a grown man and you're speaking to these kids who have manned up in many ways, they had to because of the structure, they see themselves as men, and they're ready to square off with you. And so that's talking to them at the level they think they are. I'm a man and we're men, and there's something about it. It's not about, from the outside, you can judge it as right or wrong, right? And there's definitely some lines that sometimes we cross and we remember, well, maybe I shouldn't have said it that way. These things happen whether you're cursing or not. But there's a linguistic capital talking to these young men at the level that they are, doing it when they're secret too, So they're not used to somebody calling them out like that. And when you do it, it wakes them up, right? There's something that snaps. And I've seen it personally where you say it and it shocks them into, I can't believe you just said that to me. And it's real. And it's the way that they may speak with their friends. It's an intimacy that can develop over that. Because how can you talk that way to me? And when you do it with the love, the hugs that Coach is talking about is essential because we love them hard. And so it goes both ways. There's so much that we care about that we're willing to invest and to do these things that seem crazy because we love the kid, want for them, and we love this game. Because that's the other thing. Like, we don't want you to mess up what we are building. It's not just about that one kid. It's about all these kids, right? And in my own research, I talk about this exact struggle with a kid like an RJ. Middle status, they're not the best, they're not the worst. They often think they should be the best and treated the best. RJ fits it to a T. And RJ's explanation, and you heard it throughout, Coach is the reason that I'm not the star player. And you hear Coach, we go, there's something going on with them. They're the reason, right? They're in their own way. And from the player standpoint, Coach is in their way. And we have these players who seem to get it, but they cannot get out of their own way. And it's one of these struggles. And sometimes there's trust, but other times, you know, there's a stubbornness, which has its value when you're talking about their work ethic and their desire to go through it, but they just don't fully open up. And you hear RJ, and you heard Coach say the same thing every single time. Why do you keep going inside? He just kept saying it. Why do you keep doing that? And so when you hear that, how can you not, you look at Coach, you go, well, Coach, you keep saying it. I know Coach said it 10, 15 times on just what got captured on camera. And yet RJ kept doing it. And we don't know why these kids don't always understand it. And that's, you don't have enough time in the day, right? I mean, you can't spend all that kind of time with one kid. It starts to impact the other kids, right? When you're coaching one, you're coaching them all. If you spend all that time on RJ, who are you not spending time with? It's a tough thing for a coach.
And then what they don't show too is that we had a very talented group of freshman receivers. And so I didn't want them to follow RJ's lead either, right? So when I was – and I didn't want to crush them because they haven't been around. RJ was there 4 years, right? So he's used to me, right? He's used to us. The freshmen, we're trying to work a different way. You know what I mean? And so he did – you know, we wanted to hopefully teach through RJ's, you know, time. And I think the other thing, Scott, that's really interesting, right? I had this with Houston Lillard. Damian Lillard's brother was my quarterback. And we had four receivers that year when he played for me. All four of them went Division I. And one was his good friend that he went to high school with. And he wasn't starting, and he was all upset that we were, you know, typically the coaches screwing us. So I got pissed. And I was piss. And I was like, so I went, I remember I got Houston, I got Marlon together. And I said, all right, fucking Houston, here's the deal. I put a gun to your head, Houston. I'm going to let you throw one ball. You have to complete it. If you don't complete it, I'm going to pull the trigger. You're gone. Who do you throw the ball to? Right in front of Marlon. Marlon's thinking, well, I'm going to throw it. He's going to throw it to me because I got the best hands on the team. That's what Marlon says. Houston goes, no, I'm throwing it to, you know, ED. Or I'm throwing it to Tariq. And Marlon was like the third or the fourth guys he named. And that made Marlon think, wait a minute, hold on. My best friend is telling me that in a life or death situation, he doesn't want to throw the ball to me because I'm not the most reliable. From that time on, Marlon became the most reliable receiver after that. Because like I said, and I said it in the show, and I will say it again, you can't get better if you don't think you need to get better, right? And that was the deal. He thought he was already good. In RJ's case, he struggled to get better because he didn't think he needed to, that he was already there. And guys that go, you see this, you know, watching Hard Knocks, you know, the receivers, the DBs that they talk about, some of the best in the NFL that has ever been seen. Guys are trying to get better, you know. DeAndre Hopkins is working right now with Larry Fitzgerald to get better. Now, DeAndre Hopkins may be the best receiver in the league right now, but he still knows that Larry Fitzgerald has more to give him because he used to be the best. That's the difference, right? For all of us as human beings, I go to clinics still now, coaching 40 years. I still go to clinics because I can learn something from somebody.
Coach, you talked about sometimes players needing to hear from a different voice. And we saw in Last Chance U that they did. They got to hear from Miss Cindy. Who's your wife? Talk about that, that relationship between you and Miss Cindy, and then the relationship that she has with the players as, you know, sometimes a pseudo therapist.
My wife is phenomenal, right? Now, understand that I've been coaching football 40 years. We've been married 39. So she's been to 38 years worth of football, right? She still doesn't understand the game. She knows what scoring is. She doesn't know what tackling or holding, and she doesn't understand why there's a penalty. She doesn't know where the first down is. But what she does know is human beings. And she is a caring soul and will listen to folks, right? And so over the years, you know, she's been there for me to help me get, you know, right, but also with players as well. And, you know, it's just her presence just is a calming presence. So in the case with I brought her in, what they didn't show, she came in earlier in this season during double days to do a workshop on mindfulness and breathing. And so when we fast forward and Dior's in the third week, having all this pressure from the family, the pressure having to be the quarterback, and was just too, you know, living in his car, there was so much pressure. So he came, my assistant brought him to my office. I started helping him breathe to relax. It seemed to work. We went to the field. It was just too much. So whatever I learned from my wife wasn't going to be enough. So at that point, I put him on the phone with her, and she was able to reconnect with him and help him. And then they kept the conversation all season long by text messages or phone calls. Those are little things. But I can remember even to the point that we would go see ex-players play, whether in their NFL or college, and she would always bake these scones, right? She likes to bake homemade scones to give to the kids when we go see them. You know, some a touch from home, right? They like that. And the scones are always in a shape of a star or a heart. And she would give them to them. And kids would say, "Coach, you think Cindy will bring some stars today so I can feel like a star? Or, you know, she's going to make some heart." They don't even know they're called scones, right? They just call them stars and hearts. "Is Miss Cindy going to bring some stars for me today, or make me some hearts?" Because it made them feel better and they felt like they could play better. You know, I remember when we gave it to CJ right before the Super Bowl when the Broncos beat Carolina, you know, like, "Oh, she brought me some stars," you know. And it means that, you know, that I can live up to it. I don't know if it's just a calming of influence of what she does or, you know, but that's what the symbol of those scones were. And if you ask him to the day, if you went, "Oh, CJ, I heard that, you know, coach's wife baked scones for him." He goes, "No, I don't think so." And you go, "Oh, but she makes stars and hearts for him." "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." Those, right? That's what they know him by. So again, you know, it's a little bit of a difference, but it's a calming effect for me, for the players, for everybody, right? Just because of who she is. And it's about reading people, obviously, not about the game. And, you know, she's always telling me, "Look, find the brighter side." Like if she would have more time seeing the interaction with me and RJ, I think we would have had a better relationship, right? That she would have helped me with that situation, gave me some more clues basically of how to deal with the maybe, right? So that would have been better. But again, with Dior, it was perfect, was spot on.
Well, I think that, you know, as Coach says, you have these multiple voices. Coach was bringing in a police officer who was local. You know, you get your former players who come in and they reinforce messages. And when you're coming from a place like the town, you're coming from these inner city environments, you know, we aspire to be like these people who have gone before us. You need that reinforcement that it's going to take going through something this hard in order to get there, right? There are some players and some athletes who are just willing to go through the hardest things and they never ask questions. But for the majority of us, when those things get tough, we wonder if we have to go through that, right? We wonder if we have to go through that crucible. We wonder, does it really have to be this hard? And that's part of the resistance we get from our athletes is, "I know you're telling me this and you told me it was going to be hard, but this is not clicking as quickly as I thought. Do I really have to go through this? All of this that you're asking me?" And those outside voices can reinforce, "Yes, I got to where I was because I did what Coach said." Or, "I didn't do what Coach said, and that made this thing a lot harder. It took me, I had to go, and ultimately I ended up coming back to what Coach said. I should have just listened to him." They need that reinforcement and that aspiration to have these players, these pictures, that helps to reinforce it. If you haven't won, people don't always, so we're in a culture where we talk about winning can't be everything, but I'll tell you, that depends on who you're coaching. When you're coaching kids from the town, when you're coaching kids who are from inner city environment, you need winning. You absolutely need winning, because just as Cindy talked about the brighter side, what are these kids getting that is the brighter side? There's too often it's inconsistent. They need that winning to know that the real success is possible. Otherwise, they're just getting more and more of this getting beaten up. And so winning does mean something else in that particular context. And without it, kids, because you'll have the kids that are on the winning teams that coaches coach and didn't play a minute and it changed their lives. Like, you don't have to be a starter to be changed by winning. Just being at that practice and going through it. Because coach knows he's got to push every player to play hard. Because if they're not playing hard, and even those guys who don't play on Friday nights, if they're not playing hard, your starters aren't going to get the kind of competition they need. And so then you're preaching, when we win as a team, we all win. We all get something. And that's the other thing. It's not that winning is about this greed or about something else. It's that we cannot be effective and these kids can't be transformed if they don't have something more to believe in, if they don't have that accomplishment that other kids may get just because of their resources, right? They get positive reinforcement all the time. They get all of this. Our kids are not getting that everywhere. And so we have to be consistent. We have to stay there, be there for them, and we've got to provide them with some accomplishments.
Here's something to think about too, Scott, right? Think about this. Why are gangs so popular or so strong in inner cities? They provide what a coach provides. They provide what a family provides, right? They give you a place to belong. They have structure, right? And so they're not weak-minded. They're strong-minded. They're using good psychology, right, that you want to do everything. So we need to change where they're looking for that. Young men of color are looking to belong to something, right? They've been left out of society, right? So they need to belong to something, and we have to help pick that path, you know, for where they want to go. And so for me, like at Skyline, we lifted every day. There was a place to be all summer long. Right. They came up to Skyline all summer long to work out everywhere. Right. Even if they had to go be DJing. Right. We give them a bike, whatever it takes. You have to do these things because we want you to be in this game. The gang is the Titans. Right. That's going to be positive. And so we take these groups of people from all over and you mold them into this group. And to this day, they are still strong with each other. And that's what you do. But that's what a gang does. That's what a family would do, right, in the old days, right? And we would, you know, these families. But because of society, and because of racism, and because of the different things that occur in the black and brown communities, families have been broken up, right, for all types of reasons. And so it's fragmented. And so we need to help put that back together. That's my quilt again, my fabric again, right? And how strong is that quilt now with all those pieces, right? It's real strong. Not only is it pretty, but it's strong. And those are the things that we talk about.
And coach, it feels that that fabric right now could be, is being ripped at, tugged at, pulled at, especially with the, you know, the reawakening of race in America, COVID-19, the fires happening there, right there in your backyard in California. How do you keep that quilt stitched together real tight?
Well, I'm doing it by Zoom right now, which is not as strong as it could be, right? That's like when you just, it's not really using the sewing machine correctly, right? But when you say about race reawakening, was it ever asleep?
For some, yeah.
For some, but yeah. Not for the people, right? I mean, things that were happening in the community with police brutality and systematic racism has always been there. It was shielded from mainstream, maybe, right? And the cameras and social media put it out there in the public, right? But you knew growing up, you knew what was happening out on that corner. You knew what you were getting your ass kicked, right? When you got pulled over and not arrested, right? You were just going to get an ass whooping, right? You knew that was happening. You knew who was doing it and why. That's never changed. But what we did is because of cameras now, we could say, see, you did beat my ass for no reason. You did pull me over for no reason, right? And all of a sudden, we can see it, or we can see what's happening in our classrooms now with social media, right? Wait a minute, this is teaching? And, you know, the kid films what's happening in the classroom now, right? This is not good teaching. This is not what a classroom is supposed to look like. This, look at this book. And, you know, you used to see this. This is no joke. And when I was at Frick, right? So you pass out the textbooks, right? And then, they get them from the book room. And the book, they stay with you, right? But dudes would look and say, wait, look who signed the name on the book before them, right? You know, that was someone like, you know, five generations ago. Not really, but you know how old the book, you can see, well, wait a minute, someone checked it out that long ago. And it's like, wait, how did that happen? How did that book, how come is that book so old and you're expecting me to learn new history or new math or new science when science changes every freaking day, right? It doesn't. And so how do we change those systems, right? And I don't know that we can, but I think they're there. We cannot do it by ourselves. We as a society have to do it. And so that's the reawakening, that society as a whole now see what we have seen in these communities all along, whether it was Oakland or Philadelphia or New York, you know, okay, it's changed. We put a spotlight on it. But I also want to say that not every police is bad. Now, many police are afraid to stand up for right. That's the part that bothers me, right? Like, you know that's wrong, but you allowing that. Come on, dude, really? You seen that man on his neck for 8 minutes and you telling him, man, I don't think that's good, but you ain't go grab his ass? That's the part, right? You know, okay. And the dude was just nonchalant, thinking like nothing of it, right? Now, I don't think he meant to kill him, but he didn't think it mattered enough to check either, right? So where's my human dignity to check on somebody else? My humanity that says, wait a minute, I'm restraining you. I'm not trying to kill you, right? There's two different things to this, right? And that's what's so scary, you know, like, okay, really? Do I have to pull a gun out? Cause there another way. So if he got away, I'll just catch him another day, right? You know, do we have to get him right now? You know? I mean, his back was turned. Do I have to shoot him seven times? I mean, you know, we got sticks. We got, you know, tasers. We got, okay, but let them drive away and we know what car he's in. We'll just get it another day, right? It can wait. And that's the part I think that we're missing.
Well, Coach Beam, I just want to thank you. You know, we could probably go on for another hour or so, but, you know, this was enlightening. And I think, you know, obviously we want to invite everyone to watch the documentary on Netflix. I thought it was a really great documentary. And Scott knows this about me. I'm not a sports person, but I will definitely sit down and watch sports storytelling. And I think you as a coach have done a phenomenal job. Clearly the impact and the legacy still remains to this day with Scott sharing his story about, you know, his experience through his brother and all of that. And then we see it, you know, almost every day with someone talking about you, and, you know, I mean, would you have ever imagined that you would have a full page New York Times write up on you?
No. The write up might have been because they ran my ass out of Oakland for something. You know what I mean? But not at all. Well, thank you guys. Appreciate y'all. Please stay safe and always stay positive, brother. Right. Take care now.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Coach John Beam of Laney College. We've put a link to his Netflix series, Last Chance U, in our show notes. And my special thanks to Scott Brooks, Director of Research from the Global Sport Institute, for co-hosting with me on this episode. The Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. The producer for this episode was me, Andrew Ramsamy. Our manager of marketing and communications is Crisal Valencia. Our marketing and communications assistants are Sage Piccolotti and Julia O'Connell. To stay up to date on all of our stories, events, and podcasts, be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're at GlobalSportMTRS. And if you'd like to receive our newsletter, be sure to sign up on our website. That's at globalsportmatters.com. And click on the envelope icon on the top right-hand corner of the page. Until next time, I'm Andrew Ramsamy, and thank you for listening.